Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a five-star review and share this episode. For today's episode, we have brought in a longtime cannabis entrepreneur. He is a founding member and chairman of the nonprofit Startup Syndicate, created to help new entrepreneurs get access to tools and capital for their businesses, and is the founder of Canna Devices, which serves many of the largest dispensaries in the U.S. Please welcome Chris Piazza. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Heather. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And as always, I am pleased to welcome back the leader of our amazing research team, New Frontier Data's Chief Knowledge Officer, Mr. John Caguilla.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
As always. All right. So, Chris, you have been in the industry since 2008. You started off as a glassblower. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your journey from 2008 being a glassblower to launching Canna Devices in 2018.
in 30 seconds or less.
No, I'm just kidding.
No problem. I can do it. In 2008, I had the opportunity to, I was doing seasonal work out in Colorado, and I got the opportunity to do an apprenticeship with a glassblower, Rone Glass, R-O-N-E-G-L-A-S-S, on Instagram. And he took me under his wing and gave me the opportunity to learn the trade, learn the art of glass. I'd been a long time, partaker with different glass products for a long time before that. But that was my first time in a professional sense. From there, you know, I've sort of taken an opportunity in a couple of different areas. I was doing an apprenticeship under him, and then I started my own studio and had some more artists working with me. I was in the scientific glass field, so I did some scientific glass work for the DOD and things like that. So I've had a little bit of trials in a bunch of different areas. While I had my own studio, I got into about 100 head shops as an individual artist with a couple of people working with me. And from there, stepped into this opportunity. Robert Bank, my business partner, came to me with an opportunity to start distributing glass to dispensaries. And through that 10 years or so, I was able to build quite a big network and social legitimacy, I guess you could say, among other artists in the industry. And so I had some trust built there, and I was able to reach out to them and say, hey, you know, would you guys like to work with us? And it's not an easy task to manage a bunch of artists, but we've been able to figure that out. And through that process and these dispensaries that have given us the opportunity to partner with them, Canna Devices has grown fairly rapidly. In about 3 years, we just hit officially 300 doors around the country. Hopefully that growth just keeps going. We're starting to have other companies come to us, so we're not just glass anymore. Essentially, we can sit down with a brand new dispensary owner and have every single product that they could need from the virtually as after you have the dirt and the seeds. We can help you with everything else. So that's us.
Amazing. I saw in your profile that, Canna Devices provides full-time work to roughly 50 artists at any given time, which is really incredible to have full-time work as an artist. And I think that's really great.
I appreciate that. Yeah, we're shooting to be at 100 by the end of Q1. We're starting to need some more. So if you guys know anybody, send them our way.
I will. Before we move on, John, any questions for Chris while he's in the hot seat?
Yeah, just one, Chris. I love that story, and glass has been such an integral part of the story of cannabis. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that. You said you've used a lot of glass before you got started as a glassblower. Clearly, you've seen a lot of success making and selling glass across the country. Just talk a little bit about the relationship of glassware and cannabis.
Oh, John, honestly, I'm getting tingles by that question, because that is such a special question. So there's a movie called Degenerative Art that came out, and it really talks about the industry from the glass side. You know, a lot of people that are getting the notoriety right now are the growers, right? We know the strains, we know this, we know that. And it was the scalable side of the industry. So therefore we had the corporatization of the growing of the cultivation, everything. Right. And what is being forgotten is the American glassblower was right next to those growers that were getting started, you know, 20, 30 years ago. We were all in the same boat. You know, if you knew a glassblower, you could probably find some cannabis. If you found some cannabis, you could probably find a glassblower, right? It was a symbiotic relationship. And then as the corporatization started and the scalability of one portion of that has occurred, that's what we're talking about more, right? And the American artist has been sort of lost in that. And that's a big part of our mission to bring that back. So thank you very much, John, for that question. That's, it means a lot.
Amazing. All right. Well, we're going to dive right in. BostonGlobe.com reported Omicron strains marijuana industry supply chain. So we have talked on the show many times about how the cannabis industry has proved pretty resistant to the pandemic, but they're not completely immune, especially when it comes to disruptions in their supply chain. So Chris, we all know that cannabis industry faces supply chain complications as licensed marijuana firms can't move across state lines. How would you describe the current state of the industry supply chain?
Well, I think that we have been able to weather the storm a lot better than a lot of industries. You know, we've, because we are, you know, 90% of our products are 90% of what is needed to make the product is made in the US, right? And so we're able to circumvent all of these international supply chain issues, right? But when it comes to labor and other portions of that, of the necessities needed to run a business, we're still struggling. I mean, our partners had 29 out of 34 people out at the same time with COVID. I'm hearing this from our customers that, you know, they're running skeleton crews. People that aren't sick are running 24-hour days. And so then they get sick because of that, right? I mean, it's been all over the place. I do think that we've been lucky enough to, in the weirdest way, the government's been supporting us because they allowed us to be essential workers, right? And there was some stuff that I didn't expect that occurred from this, but it's a beautiful thing that happened. And so I think that our industry has been able to thrive in a time that it, against seemingly all odds. That's just my take, I guess.
Thank you. Well, John, I know your team has been, you know, kind of watching the state of, during the pandemic and the cannabis industry. How would you describe the current state with the supply chain issues?
Well, you know, I literally just saw a stat early this morning that kind of blew me away. So in the first week of December, there were 3.3 million people who said they were out of work because they were caring for somebody who had COVID. By the beginning of January, that had gone up to 8.1 million. So, I mean, huge amount. It's not just the people who are out sick, but also the impact that it's having on people who are home caring for those people, caring for kids. Heather, I think this is happening for you in real time. It's had a dramatic impact on the workforce globally. But I think it's raised a couple of issues. One, I think for a lot of companies, it's raised this for the first time in a real consequential way, this question of continuity of operations. We've never seen disruption at this scale. We hope that we don't see it again. But I think organizations do need to really think deeply about what organizational resilience means. So if, for whatever reason, God forbid, you did end up having another situation where three-quarters of your workforce had the potential of being out, could you keep the lights on? Could you keep serving your customers? And what kind of either competencies, technologies, or personnel would you need in order to keep the engines running if this were ever to happen again? Now, we certainly hope it doesn't. We hope this ends up being an inflection moment in time and that we can learn from it. But if this has not kind of had you sit up and think, you know, God forbid this were to happen again, how can we make sure that there's no disruption to our businesses? Then I think that's a missed lesson. Two, you know, there's been two dynamics here. One is, as we think about the supply chains more broadly, you know, China has been a linchpin to the global supply chain. But to Chris's point, there's a lot of aspects of this industry that are hyper-local. They're happening in local communities. And that is actually really helpful in a situation like this where You know, you can walk down the street, so to speak, to interact with your vendor without having to worry about whether it's a Chinese factory that's been shut down, whether it's your shipping container that's stuck at a port that's not getting offloaded. The hyper-local nature, the geofenced nature of this industry, or at least for large parts of this industry, I think has helped with the ability for businesses to stay running, because there's a community element that you may not necessarily see in industries that are reliant on truly global supply chains. Now, we think over time, obviously, that's going to change. We're going to be perhaps importing more of different aspects of this market. But this geofence nature of this industry has, by our assessment, offered a bit of insulation from the trauma that we may be seeing in other sectors where you just can't get these resources in. Interesting to see that there are subsectors within cannabis that I think have been acutely impacted. So we got a notification from one of our partners yesterday about, you know, get your vape device orders in today, because the combination of COVID and the Chinese New Year will mean that your orders are going to be delayed if you don't get them in the next in the next week. But for glass, which is an artisanal aspect of this market, locally produced, I think you can be a bit more sheltered from that. So different aspects of this industry have been impacted more acutely or less acutely based on this. But broadly speaking, I think the industry, because it is relatively local, largely geofenced, has avoided some of the really substantial disruptions that have affected so many of the parts of the economy.
Yeah, it's so true. Chris, I'm currently have two out of the three, my three kids home because of COVID shutdowns and closings. And I am actually in a very good position because I can, you know, I don't have to be at a factory or someplace producing cannabis. I can actually put my kids to bed and work until 10 o'clock at night and get my work done that way. So yeah, it's definitely, I've definitely seen the impact myself. So John, I'll start with you for this one. How do you think businesses can best protect themselves from these disruptions during this like latest surge in the pandemic with Omicron being literally everywhere?
So, you know, this is going to sound a little cliche, but you've got a plan. You know, kind of think through what are the mission critical aspects of your business that you've got to have redundant on. You know, I think for so many of us, we've been doing the matrix bullet time dodging of this thing. But at this point, you know, at the rate that this wildfire has spread, it's become clear that this is going to impact the overwhelming proportion of our population. So even if you have dodged a bullet thus far, really critical to just take the time now while you can to plan for the impact that it's going to have. Just even taking the time to think about it, I think leads to more creative thinking about, well, who has the keys? And if they're going to be, you know, 50 miles away, cooped up and unable to see anyone, how do we open our shop?
Yeah, have a backup for your backup.
Absolutely. To think really creatively. I mean, remember at the beginning of the pandemic, there were cultivation facilities that brought food and cots into the grow houses so that they could kind of essentially seal their cultivation teams in an enclosed environment that minimized the risk of the grow teams being exposed during a critical part of the cultivation. Now, that might seem like an extreme measure, but for the folks who are scrambling to find backup, you know, cultivation experts that could easily walk into their facilities and take over, you know, in retrospect, having the team that really understands the space, well secured, well protected, and able to continue to serve the company, and being obviously compensated appropriately for that investment, you know, I think is just one illustration of how the lengths to which people thought creatively about how to keep their operations going with their core functional teams. And then maybe a third one is, you know, to Chris's point, think about where your supply chains and what impact massive disruption could have to where you're getting your inputs from. So do you have backup suppliers? Do you have ways of interacting with your suppliers that can serve as substitutes if their primary channels end up being disrupted? We know of packages spending weeks in in UPS and FedEx facilities because they don't have drivers, they don't have the staff to man through. Do you have alternative ways to get your mission critical inputs? Or do you have enough backup supplies that if the just-in-time delivery that you weren't expecting didn't come through, you could keep the engine running for another couple of weeks just in case? These may all seem pretty straightforward, but I think part of why this has not perhaps been given as much attention in cannabis is because the pace at which the industry is growing, the scale of people just being heads down grinding, means that there may not be a lot of this kind of meerkatting down the line to see how you can protect your business. And I hope one of the lessons coming out of this pandemic is it's really worth taking that day or two to sit down with your teams and try to put some of these plans in place. Because, you know, COVID may be a unique disaster, but we certainly shouldn't expect it to be the last disaster that disrupts our businesses in the future.
All right. Chris, anything to add or any strategies you put in place for your business to kind of protect itself?
Yeah, I think John hit it right on the head. You know, I the first one that was said about the planning ahead, I think one of the biggest problems with how these companies are being run right now is that nobody's planning ahead. And we're not even talking about, when I'm saying that, I'm not even talking about in a worst case scenario. So we have 420 coming up. I think everybody knows what 420 is. Ask me how many customers has discussed the 420 marketing plan with us, and we provide their product for it, right? And that's where I think that, like you said, we're growing so fast that nobody's able to look out ahead. There's a couple of companies that are starting to do that. They're starting to talk to us on an annual basis. Outside the cannabis industry with the large corporates, it's not uncommon to plan 2-3 years out, right? You know, Walmart has their, Christmas plan for 2023, 2024 to some degree. And we don't see any of that in this industry. So then to throw a wrench in the what seems to be a smooth running machine, then we trip and we fall on our face sometimes, right? The other thing that I think that could be very helpful for a lot of these companies is a lot of them are public now, so they have to watch their quarterly reports. So there doesn't want to be any money spent on non-revenue producing products, right? Or things or expenses. But I think that to your point, you'd mentioned, John, about the vape carts. Some of these companies are at a scale that they should be housing larger volumes so they don't have to worry about Chinese New Year coming up. And those are just discussions we're hearing. Well, can you house that for us? We'd love to buy all that, but can you house it? This is a $1 billion company and we're not a $1 billion company and they want us to house for them. And we will do it. We'll work with them. But to me, if I was running one of them, I would have just a warehouse of ancillary products so that I don't have to have a problem with the vape parts running low or the batteries running low. And so I think that the evolution of thinking about, rather than just that bottom line for the market, there needs to be some more structural analysis on how these businesses can be setting themselves up to avoid these types of things. But yeah, those are just a couple of thoughts.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned Walmart and they're just such a traditional company. Do you think that people are just heads down working and that's why they haven't planned 2-3 years, or are they just hesitant because of the regulatory changes that are happening that they don't want to necessarily have these plans put in place that they're going to have to alter? Just because I feel like a lot of people have to be pretty nimble with everything that changes on a regular basis.
So I'm going to be a little blunt here and maybe somebody might not like this, but I think that can be used too easily as an excuse. So there's a lot of things that are not that do not have to worry about any regulatory changes, right? Grinders are something that is always going to be allowed. It always has been. So why buy 1,000 of them when we could get you into 100,000 and get a discount, right? These are the types of strategies that I'm thinking about. You know, obviously the plant is just like farming. You can't do that type of thing around it, but there's all of these other pieces, display cases. Why not have some display cases so that when you open a new location, you just go to your warehouse and grab one. You don't have to worry about it being imported from China, right? There's, if you have an acquisition strategy for this year and you know you're going to open 20 locations, have that stuff ready, so you don't skip a beat. So that's kind of where I'm thinking. I totally respect that. There's a lot of stuff that cannot be planned ahead. I just think that there's at least a handful of things that could be.
I agree. I was just, it just kind of, when you made the Walmart comparison, I was like, John, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think Chris is dead on. And this has really kind of tested the idea of having the entire economy run on a just-in-time model. Because you have one link in that chain break, and it has extraordinary kind of cascading reactions. We had a first indication, or we had a good indication of this when the Suez Canal was blocked by the Evergreen ship that went kind of sideways, and ships had to travel around the world to get to their ultimate destinations. It doesn't take much to kind of create this domino effect when everybody's relying on Amazon to be absolutely on time and getting you that shipment between 10 and 11 a.m. And if it gets there a week later, then, you know, the entire system is gummed up. So I'm hopeful, to Chris's point, that we will see more of this de-risking by, it may cost a little more to carry this inventory, but it de-risks your business because it may mean that you don't have to open your dispensary a month later than you had expected because you can't get your display cases or other kind of functional materials to open the store in time.
Right. Okay, good. Well, moving on, NBCNews.com had reported on nothing has changed, frustration builds as cannabis reform stalls. So a lot of enthusiasm and optimism surrounding the potential for federal cannabis reform has dwindled in the last year, along with possibly the hope that it might be legalized or decriminalized in the near future. Chris, from your perspective, what has changed in the last year? Are things like, do you think things are as static as they appear?
Yeah, I brought it up a minute ago. I really think that the classification of essential business, now not from the government standpoint, but from the social view of cannabis, I think that changed a lot of people's eyes on how they were looking at this industry. And I think that was beautiful. There were, when cannabis was given the essential, the essential workers approval, that I can tell you from people that are not super pro cannabis that I know, started having conversations. Why would this be? They're asking questions. Why is this? Is this just about tax? It's like, no, it's helping all of these people. This is a medicine. This is all these things. And so I feel like if there's anything that changed, in my opinion, dramatically, was the social view through those, what may have not been a harder people to turn that occurred. I could say that my grandma is now using a tincture, and I don't know if that would have happened, but it became a conversation in the family. It started to be talked about a little bit more, less taboo. And so I can tell you at least one person was turned as a result of a lot of that. Another part of that question, I think that one of the biggest shames that occurred over the last year was that we didn't get safe banking. I think that that was something that should have gone across. I think that that's to use your word, John, that's a linchpin in this industry. That's going to catapult us when we can finally have legitimate banking. So I think shame on the government for not getting that across.
Yeah. John and I had discussed, there was a survey that was out. I think it was like 7 out of 10 people or majority that believe that smoking weed is morally acceptable, which was a big change from, the society's view on consumption. John, anything to add to that?
Yeah, just building on Chris's point, because I think, absolutely seismic shift in the public attitudes around cannabis. Yeah. And because it's become a kitchen table issue, both because people are being exposed to it more often. I think there's a lot of people who've been using cannabis to mitigate the effects, whether it's the stress, the anxiety, the sleep disruptions that have come from that have been induced by the pandemic. I think there's a lot of people who've been using cannabis that began to explore it as an option after they drank as much as they could at the beginning of the pandemic and realized it's just not sustainable. So they're seeking a less kind of hangover or wallet impacting alternative for the kind of socially restricted lives and lifestyle. And we're actually starting to see data that reflects a profound shift in the level of consumption in the country. And we're just talking in our research team meeting this morning about the new data out of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration that does the annual national survey on drug use and health. And we've seen a dramatic increase in the proportion of adult American adults who reported consuming cannabis in the past year. For the first time, we've seen two U.S. states, the Washington, D.C., and I believe the other one was Massachusetts, that have broken the 30 percentage point barrier. So 30% of their adults consumed cannabis in the past year. That's an astonishing number, given that when we began doing this work as New Frontier Data 7 years ago, I remember we would have long debates about whether we would ever get to 30% in any market. That just felt like a hard cap, because in the past year, that's a lot of people who are, whether it's trying it for the first time or using it semi-regularly. But I think that's part of what's been stimulated by this pandemic. It may have been people who were tire kickers, just you know, seeking something as a substitute or an alternative to alcohol, who found it to be an experience that they actually enjoyed and have therefore found ways in which they can integrate it into their lives. They're evangelizing it to their friends, to their family members. Those family members are like, well, you know, if it's helping grandmama, then, or if it could help grandmama, then let's get her on that tincture, let's get her on that edible. And it creates this snowball effect. I think we will look back at this moment, these 2 years, hopefully the pandemic ends soon, so maybe 3 years, when our lives as we knew it were foundationally disrupted, as being the moment in which cannabis became a foundationally normalized part of American society. And from our vantage point, we find it very, very difficult to see how you might be able to put that genie back in the bottle.
Yep. I remember Dr. Molly McCann on our research team had pulled out some data that parents with children, that young children had an increase in consumption during the pandemic. And I was like, yeah, it's hard being home with your kids all day long and trying to work.
Heather, just to that point, you know, we talked a lot about this over the past week, but I don't know if you saw this new campaign ad by Gary Chambers, the candidate running for U.S. Senate in Louisiana. He's literally sitting in a field smoking a blunt, and the narrative is around the prosecution of minor marijuana offenses and what impact that has had on minority communities, but more broadly on our national kind of prison population. The concept, well, just the idea that one, a serious candidate running for office, would have their first campaign ad be of them smoking a blunt in public in a state where it's not recreational legal. Two, that they wouldn't be laughed out of the room as this being an unserious candidate, an unserious person. He's well thought of, he's well liked in Louisiana. I've been struck by just seeing at least the initial social media response, where so many people have been like, hell yeah, finally.
Yeah.
It's to me just another great illustration, a great indicator of how far the cultural momentum has swung, that sort of move has not proven to be cultural suicide or political suicide. I'm not saying that he is going to be a shoo-in for his election. Louisiana is going to be a hard-won state. But the fact that it has not kind of destroyed his career out of the gate or destroyed his prospects out of the gate, I think is a reflection of Chris's point about normalization.
Yeah. And even the people that probably have been okay about it, but haven't been wanting to, you know, voice their approval for it. It's like they're coming out of the closet for being pro-cannabis, because now it's a little bit more okay to be that way. And there's a lot less, you know, pearl clutching. So, which is good. Well, what are the, do you think that the primary challenges facing the legal cannabis industry are for 2022? Chris, I'll send that to you first.
You know, I try to make sense of some of this stuff that the government does. I mean, the safe banking, I just don't understand why we haven't gotten that across. I mean, that alone will legitimize just how these businesses are run. And that will, I think that gets us to the next phase of where we can start looking at federal. I think if we go federal before we go safe banking, then I think that's putting the cart before the horse. We need to get the banking set up. We need to get the money movement set up in a proper way so that we're not opening the door for laundering opportunities, because, you know, then right now we can look at everything on a smaller scale and we can keep track of things, right? And if we just open the floodgates for federal, then now we have cross-state transmission or transport, all these things. Now things can get a lot harder to watch. And I think that's, what I want to see out of 2022 is, I mean, safe banking first. Let's get this done. Let's get the processes in place, because we all know any business that you have, if you change something that's as dramatic as of how money's handled, then you're going to find out what sort of things need to be fixed around that. then we can move to the next step. If we just jump the gun right to federal, I think we're going to have problems. So honestly, that's what I would love to see. I mean, they've been teasing it on us for a couple of years. So I'm not holding my breath on it, but that's what I want to see out of 2022.
Right. I mean, John, we did a 4-hour webinar on the CAOA and why it's just not, you know, it's not feasible right now. John, what do you have to add to that?
I actually saw something that suggests that the Pennsylvania Senate delegation is working on addressing banking independent of border reform. I think there's some concession now that just trying to get all bipartisan agreement on all of the different pieces that would constitute a national reform in this political climate, it's going to be profoundly challenging. Banking is something that, given the amount of industry given the amount of capital this industry is generating, I think you can get consensus on. So we'll see how that fares. But I agree with Chris. Every year that passes, the banking doesn't get addressed. The fact that you're adding, you know, anywhere from $4 to $6 billion a year in new revenue to this industry, it just makes the industry much more unsustainable. And the challenges of figuring out the banking issue as the industry achieves scale, much more challenging. I think a second issue that we're watching quite closely that may prove to be one of the wild cards for this industry is the broader economic climate. You know, we know that cannabis consumer demand is highly resilient. It's essentially recession-proof. People will consume cannabis in the good times and they may even consume more in the bad times. So I don't think the concern is as much about the impact that it would have on, say, retail sales in markets which are already operational. But I think there's real risk when we talk about the impact that it could have, particularly on the inflow of capital in states that are just setting up operations now. You know, the first 3 to 4 years of getting a new state market, a newly legal state market operational, are profoundly capital intensive. And so if broader economic headwinds mean that investors are writing either smaller or fewer checks to feed the engines that these companies need, then you may see a slowdown in the expansion of the industry, even if you don't necessarily see a reduction in cannabis consumer demand. One of the potential risks there is that it then kind of strengthens the illicit market so that when the capital does return, those states which were legal but didn't expand quickly enough will now be facing much more entrenched illicit markets to compete against. So this idea of the broader economic conditions and the impact that they have on the industrialization and commercialization of this industry are something we're going to be watching very closely this year.
And I just want to just jump in there, John. Like you said about the new states that are coming online, well, where does that capital end up coming from? It comes from a lot of illicit sources, right? And so we start to have that type of thing going on right from the ground up in these new markets. I mean, I'm hearing things about that going on then in some of these different states, and then it has to get worked through and worked out, right? And I think you're spot on with it. Yep.
Well, this is for both of you before we wrap up. Any expectations when it comes to federal policy for this year?
So I think there's a chance that you'll see at least a robust debate around whether banking can be done. But candidly, if the political, we're only in January and that we're already in such an acrid political environment, it's hard to see how there's going to be bipartisan consensus that will feel like either side is giving the other a win. So it's going to be a tough year to reach consensus on cannabis. This is not a hill that many politicians are willing to die on. But I agree with Chris. You know, we think that banking has a better shot than a full kind of national liberalization policy. But I certainly don't think that an attempt at, you know, full national decriminalization with FDA and DEA and all of that, I don't think that happens this year.
Yeah, my only hope for the bipartisan part is if we can figure out a way to get the banking slipped into something else and we can slide it through like we tried to once. You know, who knows? Maybe it'll come through with an interest rate hike somehow. I'd like, yeah, that's my hope, is that we can slide that through. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for your time. Chris, before we head out, we'd like to give our guest the opportunity to give a shout out to someone in the industry that's doing something great or something that's inspiring you. So you have the floor.
Well, I gotta give a shout out to Jason Spadafora, Wolf of Weed Street. Generally, I follow him on types of interviews and podcasts. So love to give him a shout out because I think he'd be a great, great person to have a conversation with.
Thank you. Well, Jason, you'll be hearing from us. Well, thank you again for joining us at Canna Week, and thank you to our listeners. Again, please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and if you really like us, leave a 5-star review. I'm your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.